Capital LLP. Mr. Shaw.
May it please the Court, my name is Pratik Shah and I'm appearing on behalf of Appellant Stone Lion Capital Partners LP. The Trademark Trial and Appeal Board below found the likelihood of confusion in granting Lion Capital's opposition to registration of the Stone Lion Capital mark. But in doing so, the Board refused to give effect to the undisputed record evidence establishing the highly sophisticated and highly regulated nature of the participants and transactions in which both parties engage. And it also refused to give effect to Appellee's critical concession that point-of-sale confusion was thus virtually inconceivable. That refusal contradicts the CCPA's mandate in the seminal DuPont decision to consider the entire record, including actual marketplace conditions, and thus constitutes reversible error. Now, to defend the Board's decision, Appellee advances two main arguments. First, they argue the record evidence and Appellee's related concession refuting any risk of point-of-sale confusion are irrelevant as a matter of law. And they also argue that confusion might arise other than at the point of sale.
Let's go back to your argument here that on the concession on confusion at the point of sale. But our case law tells us also that though we don't need to, we can address the initial interest confusion. Is there any confusion at the outset amongst investors when they're considering to invest, the initial interest?
Your Honor, there's no record of initial interest confusion in this case. And I think critically, the Board did not rely on any rationale of initial interest confusion or make any findings of initial interest confusion. What the Board said is we're going to assume the least sophisticated consumer or investor, and we don't find any sort of confusion. And I think it's good reason. Well, first let me say the fact that the Board didn't rely on such confusion sort of ends the matter there. If we look at the Supreme Court's decision in Chenery, well-established administrative law principles that this Court has adopted say you don't affirm an agency's decision on rationales or findings that the agency didn't consider. But even if we were to go beyond that, there's good reason that the Board did not rely on or make any findings relying on initial interest confusion or the other forms of confusion that Appellee allege. And that's because this Court has never embraced initial interest confusion in a Section 1052D registration action. It said, we do not embrace initial interest confusion, we're going to save it for another day, and we don't follow that concept. This would be a uniquely poor vehicle for this Court to break new ground and address initial interest confusion where the Board hasn't addressed it and where the record doesn't support that theory as well. So, and the sort of cases that the other side relies on when it talks about these other types of confusion, initial interest confusion, or the other types of confusion that it has not conceded, those are trademark infringement cases in other circuits that have recognized in the trademark infringement context some of these other forms of confusion. They rely principally on the Morningside case from the Second Circuit. That was very different in a couple ways. Legally, it was different because Morningside was a trademark infringement action, not a Section 252D registration action. Factually, it's quite different because for two reasons. One, in that case, the marks were identical or much more similar than here. It was Morningside Capital and Morningside Group. And second, there was actual evidence of confusion of some investors calling the company and mistaking it for
You've
the other.
You've got a pretty detailed opinion here that is dealing with the similarity of marks, the channels of trade, the strength of the marks, the sophistication of consumers. How would this court tamper with what is a lot of factual findings?
Well, the critical error that the Board made is it did not give any effect to the mountain of factual evidence that's basically undisputed in this case, that investors that engage both of these two parties are highly sophisticated investors in highly sophisticated transactions that leave no risk of confusion, right? The ultimate test under Section 252D is whether there is a likelihood of confusion. And if we focus on point-of-sale confusion, the only type of confusion that this Court has recognized in a 1052D context, the other side has conceded it's virtually inconceivable. Now, the Board acknowledged that evidence was there in the record, but what it said is the Board could not give it any legal effect because the Board was constrained to the four corners of the application.
The Board didn't ignore that. They dealt with it very specifically and said even sophisticated consumers can be confused by a flurry of marks that are similar.
Sure. Well, two things, Your Honor.
Do you exclude ordinary consumers seeking investment services?
Do we exclude it in the application? No, Your Honor.
No.
We
do
not
exclude them from doing business with you.
They, as a right in the marketplace, they do not. The Stone Lion Capital does not engage with ordinary consumers. They engage in highly sophisticated.
So if somebody walks by your office, sees the lion on the door, and decides they want to invest some money, come walking in, you throw them out the door.
Right, Your Honor. They're high dollar. Both parties would throw them out the door, to use your phrase, Your Honor, because both parties have high dollar minimums. They only engage in sort of very high-end transactions, so institutional investors, high net worth investors, not your retail sort of investing.
But back to the point, the Board dealt with that very directly. They said, yes, sophisticated customers, but there's still too much similarity in the marks, too much likelihood of confusion.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's quite right. What the Board said is when anyone is investing, even ordinary investors, you are right, Chief Judge Rader would say, even ordinary investors are going to exercise diligence and care when making investments. But what it did not give effect to and what it did not dispute, and neither the other side disputes, is that when you're talking about the type of transactions that these two entities engage in, those are not just ordinary investors. Those are the most sophisticated investors. And using
but
the
key is you have a, as they go on to say, applicants' identification of services, and they're identical. Why couldn't you just, if, as you suggest in your brief, you actually hit a different class to some degree, why couldn't you change your identification of services?
Sure. A couple responses. First, Your Honor, that PTO's guidance in this area is against adding restrictions, unnecessary restrictions, into the application. They say to use clear and succinct language. If you look at the Trademark Examining Procedures Manual, Section 1402.1 instructs that the description should be understandable to the average person, should not require an in-depth knowledge of the field. Board precedent says, in permitting registrations to be attacked simply on grounds that statements of goods and services are overbroad is at odds with PTO practice of encouraging applicants to set forth description of goods in broad terms. And in fact, Stone Lion Capital, when it
shows... So you're telling me you wanted to cover exactly the same services as
yes.
Lion Capital.
Yes, Your Honor. We were following the trademark manual guidance, and in fact, it says for it.
You didn't want to distinguish your services from theirs.
That's right, and we were filing.
Then why didn't you choose a different name?
Well, Your Honor.
Why did you choose a name that, to some degree, cozies up to theirs?
Well, Your Honor.
A lion is, of course, a wonderful symbol, but it's already used about six times.
Well,
Blue Lion, Roaring Lion.
Right, and Your Honor, the fact that it's been used already about six times, and we would say much more, shows that lion itself is not a strong mark that is distinctive in this industry. And Your Honor, the name of our client is not Lion Capital.
But why don't you choose something else? There are other.
Well, Your Honor, they chose.
It could be a tiger or an elephant or a.
Your Honor, they chose
Cobra.
As a practical matter, they chose Stone Lion instead of those because they're located across from the New York Library that has the Stone Lion. But to engage you on similarity of marks, sort
you
of
call it patience and fortitude. Then?
They chose Stone Lion for the reason that I told you. But if we get back to the description of services, which I think was sort of your primary legal
yes,
point,
it was.
We don't dispute that under factors 2 and 3 of the DuPont test, that is, when you're looking at the description of services and description of trade channels, we don't dispute that they're identical. Those two factors go in the other side's favor. What we're focusing on is the conditions of sale and consumer sophistication factor. And for that,
is the TTAB incorrect? I asked you a question before and you said you'd throw them out the door. It says the services offered by the parties as identified in their respective application and registrations are not restricted to high dollar investments or sophisticated consumers. Rather, applicants' investment advisory services and opposers' capital investment consultation could be offered to and consumed by anyone with money to invest, including ordinary consumers seeking investment services.
Exactly right.
Is that not true?
No, that is correct as described in the application. The record is completely clear, and the other side does not dispute, that both parties would not engage that sort of investor, even though both applications, the registration application, are technically open to those. In practice, and this is why it's critical that we look at the record evidence of actual marketplace conditions, in practice, neither party would entertain that. They only deal with the wealthiest individuals and institutions.
Why did you say that in the application?
Well, because, of, like I said, PTO guidance does that, and that's for a practical reason.
Yeah, but
it
when
becomes
you get a problem,
unwieldy.
Don't you respond to it? They're saying it's identical and you're not limiting yourself to what you actually want to do. Why didn't you limit yourself?
Two responses, Your Honor. One, it becomes unwieldy and, in fact, contradicts guidance to put in things like it's a highly consumer, sophisticated consumer base, there's a pre-existing relationship, it's a long investment cycle, we only deal with individuals with high dollar minimums. That becomes unwieldy, and that's not something the board wants in application. But to answer your question, the DuPont test accounts for this situation. Factors 2 and 3 go their way, because I agree with you completely. You look at the application, and the application services identified are identical, and the trade channels are identical. But when you get to conditions of sale and consumer sophistication, DuPont is absolutely clear that the takeaway from DuPont is you do not ignore record
evidence.
Even
if we gave you that, we'd still have the board balancing against you.
Well, Your Honor, here's why I think the balancing would overwhelmingly favor us if you actually gave effect to the undisputed record evidence and to their concession that confusion is virtually inconceivable. That is because the ultimate inquiry is whether there is a likelihood of confusion. If, based on the record evidence, confusion is virtually inconceivable, that ends the inquiry. This is a balancing fact test, and if one factor is conclusive on that test, then that ends the inquiry. And as on that point, the DuPont decision itself was very similar there. It was a party, and here's what DuPont said. I'm
just
going
to save your rebuttal time, Mr. Shaw.
Sure, Your Honor. I'll just leave you with this one point, and I'll take it off my rebuttal time. DuPont at page 1363 says this: it is at least difficult to maintain a subjective view that confusion will occur when those directly concerned say it won't. A mere assumption that confusion is likely will rarely prevail against uncontroverted evidence from those on the firing line that it is not. And I'll add one other point, realizing it'll come out of my rebuttal time, is this. If we adopted Athalee's test, that you are limited to the four corners of the application, not only for factors 2 and 3, but also for conditions of sale, DuPont itself would have come out differently. And that is clear because in DuPont, you not had similar names. You had the exact same name, Rally for car detergent, Rally for all-purpose detergent. The descriptions in the application were completely overlapping. The reason DuPont came out differently is because it looked at a market agreement where they said they were going to, in practice, advertise to different consumer bases, that the all-purpose detergent wouldn't advertise to car retail stores. And because of that specific practical evidence outside the scope of the application, the court said no likelihood of confusion. DuPont would have come out differently under their test, and that's why you shouldn't adopt it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Chiappetta?
Yes, Mr. Chiappetta, does your client concede there's no likelihood of confusion?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. To be very clear, my client's concession was that if a party was to undergo the entire due diligence process entailed by one of the party's funds, they would not get all the way to the end of that thinking they were dealing with the other party. At some point along the way, any confusion would be dispelled. But that's irrelevant for a couple of reasons. One,
why is that? Because of the sophistication of the investor increases as you get down further into the process? What are you doing, winnowing out the the unsophisticated investors?
No, I mean, the supposition in this hypothetical is that the investor is confused at the outset, and then they sit down, when they get in the door, they have an interview with one of the parties, and then at some point along the line, they realize, oh, wait, this is not the hedge fund that I thought it was, this is somebody else, or vice versa. It's a 30-day due diligence period. So my client does not dispute that there just wouldn't be confusion and would carry all the way through that 30-day period. But that's ignoring what's at issue in this case. What's at issue in this case is somewhat narrow. It is the Stone Lion Capital's application to register its mark in connection with all investment advisory services. It's unlimited. If they get a registration, they will have a presumptive right. That registration will qualify as prima facie evidence of its right to use its mark in connection with all investment services. That right would not, that presumption would not be limited to their current hedge fund. It would not be limited to super wealthy investors or the SEC regulations.
Why is Stone Lion different from Blue Lion?
Blue Lion, first their mark is Stone Lion Capital. Our mark is Lion Capital.
Blue. And there is an existing mark, Blue Lion. Why is Blue Lion allowed and Stone Lion not?
Well, first, there's a couple of responses.
Or Roaring Lion.
Okay.
Or Lion Hound.
There's no evidence.
Or Lioness Capital.
Well, there's
or Lion Chemical Capital. There's about six lions out there.
There's no
and
evidence
why
of
is
that.
Why does Stone Lion get nailed and not Blue Lion?
The answer to that is that there is no evidence that there's third-party marks, there's third-party use. As the board found, there was only evidence of two marks, okay, and that was Lion Chemical Capital and Blue Lion Capital. And the evidence was scant as to the extent of the use of those marks.
And why is Blue Lion? Why isn't Blue Lion the same as Stone Lion?
Well, I'm not saying necessarily that it isn't as problematic. It very well may be. It's not incumbent upon a trademark owner to go after each and every single third party using a similar mark. The law recognizes that mark owners have limited resources and they can go after one at a time if need be. The point is that there's only two, and the board correctly found, in accordance with well-established precedent, that two instances where the extent of that use is in question is not sufficient to render the third-party marks factor to favor Stone Lion Capital. So it concluded that this factor was, in fact, neutral. It didn't find one way or another that it favored either party. In fact, it's worth noting that, you know,
why wouldn't it favor Stone Lion if haven't heard an answer to my question. What's the difference between Stone Lion and Blue Lion? You're just saying we want to get Stone Lion. We don't care about Blue Lion.
No, I'm not saying we don't care about Blue Lion. It may be the case, depending on the facts and circumstances surrounding Blue Lion's use of its mark, it may be the case that they will go after that party. It may be the case, look at the evidence, that Blue Lion Capital is virtually unknown and therefore it's not a significant concern. You have to bear in mind that third-party use is only a problem to the extent that it's actually those marks are used in commerce and to the extent that those marks are affecting the way consumers perceive the party's marks. Even Stone Lion Capital COO, who's been in 20 years in some of the most prominent investment firms, said that she had never heard of Blue Lion Capital. This is not a problem. This might not be a problem for my client. What is a problem and what is at issue in this case is Stone Lion Capital, but not just Stone Lion Capital, their application. Now, this argument that they keep putting forward that you need to consider the due diligence, you need to consider the SEC regulations, you need to consider all these extra application concerns is the exact same argument that was put forth in Octocom Systems versus Houston Computer Services. This court and the board has addressed this issue many times over the last few decades, this issue being when there's a difference between the goods and services in an application and the goods and services that the parties are actually putting out there. And in Octocom, the appellant was sanctioned for the very same argument that Stone Lion Capital is making here today. This court concluded that the appellant was blindly disregarding long-established authority.
What's the blind?
Well, I'll tell you. In that case, the appellant had an application.
You're accusing your your brother counsel here of disregarding authority. What authority are they disregarding?
The ample authority that what is at issue in an opposition proceeding is the identification set forth in the application, regardless of what may be how the parties may actually be using their goods. This court is not, the board and this court cannot read into an application some limitation that's not on the face of the application, because the application gives rise to presumptions, to prima facie evidence.
Mr. Shaw didn't want to amend. He didn't want to say they're doing something different. He was very forthright in saying,
correct,
we wish to have the entire scope of what we've applied for.
That's right.
So what's your problem?
And they cannot run from that. My problem is then what's at issue in this case is all investment advisory services. And who they're taking issue with the sophistication of consumers. Who are those consumers of all investment advisory services? Anybody, as the board correctly noted,
anybody
with money
in off the street.
Anybody with money to invest. That is the issue. The issue is what this application and the registration that would issue from it, not these extra application factors that they keep trying to bring into this case. Okay? In that court, as this court just 10 minutes ago noted, Stoneline Capital argues that the board ignored all this evidence of consumer sophistication, extra application considerations. In the Octocom case, the court said no. The board did not ignore that evidence. It just concluded properly, in accordance with well-established precedent, that evidence is irrelevant to the issue, namely the issue of what is in that application. Their application in that case was for modems. They were saying, oh, but you have to consider our consumers. These are high-end modems, and they're sold to very sophisticated consumers,
but
and they're sold under conditions.
The board put this in issue. The board says careful or sophisticated purchasers are not immune from confusion.
Well, that's
so
right.
They seem to be saying, yes, there are sophisticated consumers here, but they're not immune from confusion.
That's right. And that's been our position throughout.
Well, but
that
runs contrary to
what they say,
everything we have done in saying that sophisticated consumers, by their nature, are more discerning as to source denotation and better at making distinctions.
I think if you look at what the board said, the board didn't actually say that the relevant consumers here are sophisticated. They said everybody takes care with how they spend their money, how they invest their money.
And they also say, in a paragraph above I quoted, they say anybody is offered this service, including ordinary consumers seeking investment services. And then they say, although even ordinary consumers will exercise care, sophisticated purchasers are not immune.
Right.
But they're saying ordinary purchasers, ordinary consumers, may be under the application, may be using this service.
That's right.
They haven't changed that.
So you have to take them into account as well as the party's actual consumers, who may be wealthy investors with $5 million portfolios. But you have to take into account anybody who's willing to invest money, somebody who's filling out a 401k form and sees a mutual fund. If tomorrow Stoneline Capital was to go out and start a mutual fund or a college tuition fund, a registration that issues from this application would cover those services. Okay? So any employee at any place of business who's filling out a 401k form, they are to be considered within this group of investors. They criticize the board for coming up with a hypothetical class of ordinary investors. But that's precisely what the board is charged with doing, determining who are the investors of, look at the application, investment advisory services, management of investment funds without limitation. And then further on the point of sophistication, the board also noted, it said that even careful or sophisticated purchasers are not immune, as you noted. But then it took into account the fact that the marks are similar, that the services are legally identical, the trade channels and target consumers are legally identical, points which Stoneline Capital does not dispute. So on balance, considering that human memories are not infallible, any sophistication, whatever that may be, of an ordinary investor with money to invest who might take care with his money It just is not enough to overcome these overwhelming factors that favor a finding that confusion is likely. And then I really want to turn attention to one other factor that that Stone Lion Capital addressed in its brief but didn't address today, and that's the similarity of the marks. I think it's important to address because they make a major mistake.
They didn't address it today. Why would you want to address it?
What I want to address is a mistake in the burden of proof. I'm sorry, in the standard of review that they put in their brief. Their standard of review...
I'm giving you a hint.
Yeah, okay. Much appreciated. For what it's worth, the standard of review is substantial evidence. It is a fact finding. They said it's not a fact finding. This court is to have no deference to the board's finding, and that's just not the case. In Ray National Data, the cite they case does not say that. Nowhere does it counter the substantial evidence standard. And
isn't your core beef that the confusion is the person who walked in the door, not the person who walked out the other end of the process?
My core beef is the person that walks in
the door. The confusion is for the person who walks in the door at the outset, not the person who walked out the door at the end of the 30 days.
Well, our core beef in this case, this opposition proceeding, has nothing to do with these real-life scenarios that you're putting forth. It's the application which considers... Remember, this is an intent-to-use application.
I understand, but what I'm talking about is your concession that there would be no likelihood of confusion.
Right. If this case was ever to turn into a litigation, okay, and we were to then necessarily address the use of the marks, yes, our concession takes the out the door at the end of the process off the table. And then all of those arguments, Stone Lion Capital criticizes us for making arguments about pre-investment confusion scenarios. All those arguments, incidentally, are in response to their argument that you should consider these extra application factors. Those are at the end of our brief, pages 40 to 47. You do not need to get to those. But if you're inclined to disregard Legion precedent that what's at issue is the application and not the party's goods, then I ask you to turn your attention to these other arguments that, in fact, would become directly front and center should this ever develop into a litigation. They also argue that we haven't, when we put forth these pre-investment scenarios, that we have not proven that they're likely to occur. But we have proven, and the way we have proven is the DuPont factors. That is how you prove likelihood of confusion in an opposition proceeding. You prove how each of the DuPont factors favors your case, and you prove how on balance they tip in your favor. That is how we did it, and that's how the board found the likelihood of confusion. And then finally, I'd like to leave the court with the several guiding principles that govern all opposition proceedings. While we don't think this is a close case, considering that all the relevant factors tip in favor of likelihood of confusion, to the extent there are any doubts, it is well established by the board and this circuit that all doubts are resolved in favor of the prior user. Newcomers have the obligation to avoid even coming close to pre-existing marks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Shaw, you have a minute and a half.
Sure, Your Honor. Let me make two points. First, I think this case boils down to a pure analytical legal question is, can you look beyond the applications when evaluating factor four, the conditions of sale and consumer sophistication? Their best case to say no is Octocom. Octocom in that line of cases is fundamentally different. What you're talking about in Octocom in those cases are factors two and three, the description of the services and the trade channels. And what's happening in those cases is an applicant is trying to narrow its description by relying on actual marketplace considerations to distinguish themselves from the registrar. We're not doing that.
Mr. Shaw, can you tell us that your client will never offer a college education fund?
There is absolutely no evidence in the record that suggests our client is planning to do that. I can't say 100% ever, but their burden is by preponderance of evidence to show a likelihood of confusion. They have conceded virtual inconceivable.
Sure you can bind your client never to offer anything other than the services it's offering now.
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to do that, but if my client say, to address your concern, tomorrow, if this court were to reverse, started offering other services, they are free to bring an infringement action that takes into account the actual use and say, oh, look, now they're actually doing something that runs some risk of confusion. But on the record now, it's undisputed there is no risk of confusion.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. That concludes our hearing.
All rise.